This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. One of the most disturbing and confounding moments in American history was the systematic executions of women and some men accused of witchcraft in Salem, Massachusetts. A new avant-garde play explores the events of this period while bucking the historical context of 17th century America. When we were joined by historian Stacy Schiff, we got a thorough breakdown of the period and what fueled the hysteria of these people who took part in this literal witch hunt. Schiff is the author of The Witches, Salem, 1692, and she joined us last year to discuss what she found. Let's listen. So much has been written about this time in colonial history, books and of course, plays and things. Was there a story you were trying to set straight that, because I think we know this story, but I think you're trying to tell us something different.
Well, you know, one of the appeals of this was that we're all familiar with the word Salem witch trials, but I don't know that we all know what those words mean. And I think the misconceptions here, I felt the misconceptions here needed a little bit of addressing. The entire episode will take place in 9 months. It goes at this galloping pace. It isn't a matter of male crime. It isn't male finger pointing at women. Many of the victims are men. Those who are doing the accusing are primarily and initially prepubescent and pubescent girls, which I think most people don't know. One of the victims is a minister. I just think there was an enormous amount here that we tend to either take from Arthur Miller or take from myth. No one burns for, I should also add,
well,
the witches
that
are
was
hanged,
interesting, right?
Which is a late arriving addition to the story that we burned witches in New England. So I felt that there was a lot to be dusted off here, and I felt that we had never really understood how these people came to these conclusions and what was driving them, both the accusers and the accused.
You also say this was the best educated community in the world at that time, a very educated community that did believe in witches, which wasn't that unusual, I guess, in 1692. But I think in 2015, we wonder, how is that possible?
It was imperative, and this was one of the things with which I wrangled when I started work on the book, to impress upon the reader that a witch, as a 17th century New Englander understood him or her, because it could be a man as well as a woman, was a figure of religion, was a religious construct. It was not a superstition to believe in witchcraft, that everyone, to a man in New England, would have subscribed to witchcraft. And in fact, the belief in witchcraft will survive the trials, bizarrely. Mm-hmm. And that the most erudite men in the colony are the ones who tend to know the most about witchcraft because they have whole library shelves devoted to the topic. It's a scientific study, in fact. And to somewhere somehow make clear that we too have our scientific ideas, which turn out to be perhaps ill-founded, as was the belief in witchcraft at the time.
But you're saying, don't make fun of these people. Take this seriously.
Absolutely.
And because they took it seriously.
They take it seriously. And we, too, have believed in several things that have not proved to exist. So there's really no reason to in any way demean them for this particular, what we consider to be a loony, superstitious thought.
Well, let's go back to 1692. These two young girls begin to act strangely. What do people report?
The two girls seem, as you say, were convulsing and twitching and flying across rooms and speaking gibberish, and they at one point interrupt sermons. No one jumps to any immediate conclusion. There seems to be a certain amount of moderation and hesitation in diagnosing them initially. It's fairly clear that these are the same symptoms that an earlier set of children had suffered in a 1688 case of witchcraft. And those children were Boston children. The woman who was said to afflict them will hang on Boston Common. Mm-hmm. And that is the prior witchcraft case, prior to 1692. And these kids seem to have precisely the same illness. It seems to be within 3 to 6 weeks, it's understood that what they are is bewitched. And, of course, once they are said to be bewitched, the names of several witches emerge. So three Salem villagers are immediately named. And they are the three likely suspects. One is a very litigious woman. One is a slave in the household of the minister.
Tituba,
exactly, and whom many of us know from Arthur Miller. And the third is a local beggar woman who's been a menace and a difficult house guest. And I think if you had to vote anybody off the island, she would have been the person.
Of course, what's so fascinating is how these early accounts, you know, of twitching and speaking in gibberish, how that begins this kind of almost like hysteria, and then the accusations begin, and then people are arrested. How do you understand the sort of building of these events?
I think the contagion factor can't be underestimated here. Remember that if everyone does believe in witchcraft, and witchcraft is understood to be at work, and you're sitting next to someone who seems to be exhibiting these kinds of symptoms, there's a power. I mean, I'm not a doctor, but the power of suggestibility there is huge. And these are adolescent girls, which I think adds somewhat to the mix. Everyone who there's a core group of bewitched victims of witchcraft, and they tend to be girls between the ages of 10 and 20, and they are the central figures here. They are the finger pointers, and interestingly, they go from being bewitched to being the ones who are really running the show. They're the ones pointing the fingers. They're the ones who appear to be naming the names. And repeatedly, they will be called in to almost guide the justices in their work. So they become, they end up serving as sort of experts and advisors and ultimately even as visionaries. People will bring their sick children to these girls to say, could you tell me who might be witching my relative? So they really play this outsized role given their age and their power.
Do you see this as a kind of revolt, maybe a revolt against their Puritan upbringing or what it was like to be a Puritan child at this time?
There are two things I think there at work there. There is clearly an enormous spiritual strain on these girls, and we don't know that from them because, alas, to the historian's great regret, we don't have any diaries or anything from this particular cohort of girls. We have nothing. We have no Puritan girls' diary. We do have, though, traces of what other adolescent girls at the time were feeling, and I'm thinking largely of Samuel Sewall's daughter, who at 15, and this is a few years after Salem, will experience what we would call sort of a nervous breakdown, and will be inconsolable. She's in tears night and day, and what has come to torment her is the idea that at 15 she has already sinned too much. There's no hope for her salvation, and she is a reprobate through and through.
What does that tell us? What is she referring
to? She's referring to the Bible that she's been reading and the sermons she's been hearing. Later in the same household, another servant will knock on lovely Justice Sewall's door and say, at night, at midnight, and say, I can't get over the images. I can't get past the images that I heard in this morning's sermon. I can't sleep. I'm terrified. It does give you something of a sense here of what's Puritanism was not easy on anyone. It was particularly difficult, I think, on the young children. And I think the adolescent thing does play a huge role here on so many levels in terms of the girls. And there seemed to be so much settling of debts with their elders. This is a moment when those who confess and those who are bewitched will point their fingers at older people and often their own mothers and grandmothers. And I think that's, for me, one of the most shocking things about it. You have moments here where you have a girl in court who's confessing to witchcraft and blaming her mother and her grandmother for having recruited her for the devil. So if that isn't an adolescent revolt, I'm not quite sure what is. But you have it in terms of the colony as a whole as well toward the mother country.
You also describe, and interestingly, a number of these women who were accusers worked as servants. And you describe what it's like for servant girls to be working in people's houses, the kind of abuse, frankly, that they had to put up with.
The Puritans, for reasons that we've never entirely understood, engaged in this habit of binding children out, which was to say sending them to another household, essentially to learn better manners, but to work there, to understand, in this case, housewifery. And therefore you have a lot of girls living with men who are not their biological fathers. Many of these girls have, in fact, lost their biological fathers, but who are living in households where the rules are different, in a state of some discomfort, and often alongside male servants who take advantage of them as well. And there are quite a few cases in those wonderful books I was just mentioning, The Quarterly Courts, of terrible sexual abuse, of masters abusing their servants. We just don't happen to have the documentation. But the vulnerability in general would have been great, whether it was from the men of the house or the spiritual stress or the community at large or that sense that at any moment you might be carried off by Indians.
And the sense that these girls were in many ways alone in the world. I mean, there was no one there to directly protect them from these dangers.
You know, you're reminding me of this moment where one of the two parsonage girls, in fact, is in a tavern by herself, which is interesting, I think, and asks a young man, a young farmer in his 20s, to protect her. Because she says she can see a witch in the room and was about to attack her. And this young man, very valiantly, first with his pitchfork and later with his rapier, will try to protect her from these spirits whom she alone can see. It's a strange kind of blind men's bluff moment. But the power that she's able to exercise at that moment and the way she's able to solicit his aid, I think would have been just, you know, head-spinningly delicious.
Yeah. One more thing, just to add to the complexity and frankly, the horribleness of this whole situation, is that you describe what was like being in jail in Salem and just not just how cold it was, but how, I guess, dank. People were hungry.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, Marty, because I think we forget that when you get shipped off, first of all, the trials don't take place immediately. And in many cases, people confess to witchcraft, which means they go back to jail. They don't get tried. So you have people who are in jail here for 3 to 6 to 9, in one case, 15. Tituba's in jail for 15 months. And a 17th century prison was not a place where anyone expected to spend a lot of time because the workforce is very small and the labor is infinite. You didn't really want to lock people up. So these are not facilities that have been built for either any kind of comfort or any long-term stay. So they're extremely cold, bitingly cold. The wind is rustling through in the winter, and they're oppressively, stiflingly hot in the summer. Moreover, just to add insult to injury, the habit was that you paid for your jail fees, for your provisions, for your blankets. You paid to get your relatives out of jail. So you're paying for the indignity of being jailed for these months. People die there, and people have babies there.
In fact, you describe some children that were in chains, right?
Everyone is chained because it was thought that way you could somehow a witch could not afflict if she were chained. Yes, exactly. So there's a little girl, there's a homeless 5-year-old girl who's in chains.
So is it just a people gone mad?
Well, it's hard to say people have gone mad when this works so well for so many people. There are a lot of reasons both for, I mean, as I hinted with Cotton Mather, both for the ministers to appreciate this particular epidemic. The authorities are themselves in the midst. This is a fledgling political administration. The authorities are themselves in the midst of propping up a new government. It's very important that the civic authorities and the ministers remain in lockstep, which means that no one can really shut the trials down or even express any kind of skepticism. And obviously the contagion factor, and a lot of people are busy settling unsettled scores, so it works for them. So the contagion factor here is immense when you realize where you can go with this and when you buy into it.
That was my 2015 interview with Stacy Schiff, author of The Witches, Salem, 1692, about the historical context of the Salem witch trials. When we get back from the break, we'll hear my conversation with physician David Cassaret about the medical benefits of marijuana. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks again for joining us today. This past weekend, Pennsylvania legalized medical marijuana. After years of skepticism from the public and even within the medical community, state after state has been legalizing the medicinal uses of the once stigmatized drug. One such skeptic was Pennsylvania physician David Cassaret. But after seeing firsthand the benefits of cannabis, from reducing seizures to alleviating the side effects of chemotherapy, Cassaret changed his tune and has become a champion. He joined us last year to discuss his book, Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. Let's listen.
I do want to talk about what is in marijuana because you tease some of that apart, but is it also about dosage, which, you know, probably varies from dispensary to dispensary, maybe even from state to state?
It varies a lot depending on where you buy it and who you buy it from. It's also increased over time. So the concentration of THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the active ingredient, if you will, it's certainly not the only active ingredient, but it's the ingredient in marijuana that makes you feel high. Other cannabinoids might have other effects, but they don't give you that feeling. The average THC concentration in marijuana that's been found by police and confiscated has increased over the last 15, 20 years from about 3% up to about 8, 9, 10%.
Oh, wow.
Which means that there's a huge variation in what you might be getting.
But you also seem to indicate, even beyond your back, but also looking at some of the other uses of marijuana, is that it seems to have some effectiveness with things like nerve pain. Yes?
Yes.
Did I read that right?
You did, and that was a big surprise to me. I thought that the benefits of medical marijuana, if there were, would be just the euphoria, right? It would make you feel good. But it turns out there really are medical effects, and those medical effects come partly from THC, partly from cannabidiol, or CBD, which is the other main ingredient. And some of the best data actually come from the treatment of neuropathic pain. There have been several good randomized controlled trials that have found that smoked marijuana containing THC and CBD can be effective in reducing pain due to neuropathic pain, which is pain that's caused by an injury to the nerve itself, as opposed to regular pain from, say, a broken leg that's caused by stimulation of a normal nerve. This is a problem with the nerve itself that can happen after chemotherapy, with conditions like diabetes, sometimes lupus or other autoimmune diseases.
You mentioned THC. That's where the, I guess, the euphoria comes from that.
Exactly.
And the other one, CBD, B as in boy, D as in dog. How does that work?
It's fascinating. We're not really sure. It's become, I describe it in the book, as kind of the quiet cousin to THC. THC is the molecule, the cannabinoid in marijuana that gets all the attention because it's pretty obvious what it does. It makes you stoned. CBD doesn't have any psychoactive effects. So even in studies that have given people really massive doses, 500-600 milligrams of CBD, people don't get euphoric. They don't get stoned. And so people didn't really imagine that it might have some sort of medical effect. Huh. What does it do? We're not really sure. There's some evidence that it's responsible for part of the effectiveness in neuropathic pain. In fact, Barth Wilsey, who is a researcher and anesthesiologist that I talked to in researching stoned, has become increasingly interested in the possibility that some of his studies that have found benefits of marijuana on neuropathic pain, those benefits might actually come as much from CBD as from THC, or maybe even more.
Huh.
So he's doing trials now that decrease the amount of THC, increase the amount of CBD.
Well, is there, though, the relief that you get from euphoria, the THC part of marijuana, which is maybe you care less or you're less sort of anxious about how you feel, so you get some relief from it?
That might be part of it, sure. And I think one challenge to all of this research is it's hard to tease apart what these various cannabinoids do. There are dozens of cannabinoids in a marijuana plant. And so when you smoke a bud from that plant, you're getting THC and CBD in varying amounts, and you're getting a lot of other stuff too. So it's hard to tell what those effects are. But some of those effects probably are euphoria. But the effects related to CBD are probably independent of just feeling good. Mm. There's probably something real there, we think.
You tell a number of interesting stories, including one about a young girl named Randy who developed severe seizures that happened many, many times a day. Her parents were beside themselves trying to figure out what was the cause and how to treat it, and they turned to marijuana. Tell us that story.
So Randy, when she was only a few months old, started having severe seizures, pediatric seizures, pediatric epilepsy, was diagnosed as having Dravet syndrome. And Cal and Cindy saw many neurologists try multiple drugs. Meanwhile, Randy's seizures kept getting worse and worse to the point where she was having sometimes 6, 7, 8, a dozen seizures a day.
Wow.
With significant consequences both to her mental development and to her health. And so they turned not to marijuana, but to a very concentrated CBD oil. So oil that's given in small drops with very, very high concentrations of CBD. Again, that's the cannabinoid, one of the cannabinoids that doesn't make you euphoric. So it's not like Randy was getting high or stoned. There are really no more psychoactive effects to CBD than there are, say, for aspirin.
Mm. Well, does it also complicate it that marijuana is still considered to be a Schedule I drug? I mean, as far as the federal government is concerned, it's basically an illegal drug.
Which is a huge challenge for researchers and then, by extension, for patients. If it's an illegal drug, it's hard to do research. And if it's an illegal drug, the federal government isn't going to fund therapeutic trials. And there's sort of a catch-22. One of the elements of a definition of a Schedule I substance is a substance that has risks that offers no benefits.
Right.
But
right.
you can't really demonstrate that it has benefits unless you do clinical trials, but the federal government isn't going to fund clinical trials. We're kind of stuck.
Your book is subtitled A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana, and having read the book, I mean, that's not exactly what this book is about. But are you saying that we should do more research, certainly on medical marijuana, and try to follow up on some of these anecdotes to see if it's true or not?
Absolutely. I was asked actually to give a congressional briefing last week by Representative Blumenauer's office, not about medical marijuana or ethics or law, but about the need for more and better research. And the argument that I was given in being asked to give that briefing was that's something that the representative's office thought that everybody in Congress should be able to get behind. And not just research on benefits. So we certainly need clinical trials on benefits, but we also need to understand a lot more about potential risks.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the risk studies out there have been done on recreational marijuana users. And to say, for instance, that a kid who's in his 20s who uses marijuana 3 or 4 times a week with a lot of other drugs at parties may be more likely to develop psychiatric illness, maybe. But to say then that an administrative assistant at the University of Pennsylvania who uses it once a week to get to sleep, is she really going to have the same outcomes? We just don't know. So we know very, very little about the risks of medical marijuana use, and we need to know more.
Is marijuana any harder or easier to study than any other drug?
It's a little bit harder in the sense that it's an illegal substance.
Yes,
which
but
makes
even
life...
beyond that, just as a drug itself, as a chemical.
Yeah, one of the biggest challenges is that it's not a chemical, right?
Ah,
I mean, marijuana is a collection of chemicals. And that's the way you phrase that is perfect, because that's what makes it so difficult. You may do a study, I may do a study, but if we're studying different strains of marijuana with different components, we may get different results.
You did spend some time, as you said, in some dispensaries. I mean, what is that like, and how were you treated there?
Very differently than I was in the clinic. And I'm glad you asked that, because that was really eye-opening to me. I met a patient who at one of the clinics who then took me to the dispensary that she went to actually buy the marijuana once she had a letter of recommendation. And again, you know, there are probably some dispensaries that are more sleazy mm-hmm. or fly-by-night organizations. Mm-hmm. There's a huge variability. But the dispensaries that I was fortunate to go to, again, and mostly in Colorado, Oregon, and California, really were very much full-service operations with staff members who really took the time to explain things. Also, patients, customers who would hang out there and talk with each other. It was, I describe it in the book as being a combination of a clinic and a pharmacy and a block party and a support group all rolled into one.
I mean, a very different kind of experience than you might get at a pharmacy, for instance.
At a pharmacy or a regular medical clinic. I think a lot of people were finding that needs were being met, needs for social support, needs for advice and education, needs for symptom management. We're finding those needs being met at some clinics and some dispensaries in ways that they hadn't been met in their doctor's clinic.
In fact, you had a piece recently in the New York Times basically saying perhaps there are some lessons from these dispensaries that can be applied to the medical world in terms of taking time with people, sharing information, feeling as if you're being heard.
I think that's true, and that's hardly a revolutionary statement. The idea,
no, but it's interesting to take your experience there and say, you know, there's a reason these people are here besides just that they want marijuana. They're getting something else.
That's true. And I think many people ask me why on a national level there are now 23 states and the District of Columbia in which medical marijuana is legal, whereas it's still a Schedule I substance. And there really haven't been at least as many randomized controlled trials as you'd think, given that there are at least 1 million registered users. And one explanation for that is that I think there's been a groundswell of enthusiasm, at least in part because people are not getting their needs met by their clinics, their hospitals, and their doctors. And so the enthusiasm for medical marijuana may have outstripped the data. That's probably a fair criticism. But that criticism can also be turned around and leveled at the medical establishment. I think we're not necessarily meeting our patients' needs as much as we could be.
And how about things like lung damage? If people, and this would be, I guess, smoking a lot of marijuana, does it hurt your lungs?
It seems like it should. I mentioned there were a couple of surprises, and that was one. You'd think it would. You're inhaling the same kinds of stuff you inhale in tobacco, tar, particulates, just nasty stuff you don't want in your lungs. It turns out that there don't seem to be any long-term lung risk. There are some subtle changes in lung function tests for people who use a lot, meaning several joints a day. Nobody really sure why that is. The simplest explanation is probably the best, and it's a matter of dose. So for people to get long-term lung damage in the form of emphysema, many of the patients, when I work at the VA, years ago I took care of guys who had smoked two or three packs a day for 20 or 30 years and wound up with significant lung damage. But imagine what kind of shape you'd be in if you smoked 20 or 40 joints a day for 20 or 30 years. Your lungs would be the least of your problems. So it may be that in the doses that people usually get, a joint a day, lung damage or forms of lung cancer or throat cancer don't seem to be a risk.
Is there a connection between perhaps a repeated use of marijuana, even for medical reasons, and brain damage? Is there a connection there?
You mentioned for medical use, and we really don't have enough experience with medical use, so that to me is a wide open question. The data we have on long-term changes in thinking, memory, and brain structure come from recreational users. And what you think of those data depends, I think, in partly on what your bias is. I tried to come at this with an open mind, and I'm not sure. I'm not convinced there's a smoking gun that we definitely know that chronic use causes brain changes, but I think that is still a risk based on what I've seen. The problem with a lot of those studies is people use lots of other drugs, and it's hard to disarticulate them sometimes.
You did look, or some people have looked at post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and marijuana. Again, what's the latest on that?
Well, unfortunately, we don't really know. And I say unfortunately because that's one of the most common uses that I ran across in interviewing patients in clinics and dispensaries. It's a condition that a lot of people are turning to marijuana for. It's a condition that people are turning away from the health system for because the drugs they're being prescribed cause side effects. Many people tell me they're unpleasant or they don't work. And so there's a large sense in many of the patients I talk to of desperation turning to medical marijuana, as was the case in one patient whose story I described in detail.
Yeah.
But we really don't know. There have been a couple of small studies, one retrospective study asking people, when you started using marijuana, did it make you feel better? One prospective clinical trial that was done in Israel. They used very, very high concentrations, about 20% of THC in that marijuana, and reported some improvement. But there haven't been, to my knowledge, randomized controlled trials. Sue Sisley, who is a physician in Arizona, has been trying to do these trials for a while, but keeps running into regulatory roadblocks because it's a Schedule I substance and so on. So there's definitely interest in doing these randomized controlled trials. We need them. Mm-hmm. Until then, I think people are taking their best guess and trying.
As a palliative care physician, do you find a lot of your patients do use medical marijuana, whether prescribed or not?
Right. It's hard to tell. I'm in Pennsylvania where medical marijuana is not yet legal. I certainly have, in the process of writing this book, started to pay attention when patients ask me in general ways what else might help them. When patients tell me, well, I've heard about medical marijuana, do you think that might help me? I'm always careful to clarify that I can't recommend it because it's illegal here. But I've become more open to walking them through, without providing a recommendation, walking them through what we know. And I've been surprised by how many people tell me, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I've been using it for the last couple of months and it works well. They didn't open with that. They didn't tell me that up front. But I think for every person who tells me that they are using it, there are probably many more who are curious to see what I think but aren't going to divulge that.
You did try a couple of, I think, some wine that was laced with marijuana, some beer. I mean, there are, I guess, some substances where marijuana has absolutely no effect whatsoever.
Well, it's not a matter of no effect, right? But there's actually an interesting science to trying to get the active ingredients of medical marijuana, THC, CBD, other cannabinoids, out of the plant and into some form in which you can use it. And you mentioned that I did try tea, beer, and wine. And I did that very strategically because the science of how you get THC out of a bud is really kind of boring. I mean, it's fascinating if you're a geek like me, but if you just want to know how to use it, it's boring. And so I tried to tell stories in a way that made it more interesting and engaging. And the short summary is that in order to get those active ingredients out of marijuana, you need something that THC or CBD like to dissolve in. In general, that's high concentrations of alcohol or fats, lipids, like butter or oil.
Like brownies, right?
Brownies. So the recipes out there that seem to be effective at getting those active ingredients out of the bud into some form in which you can ingest it involve things like butter or olive oil or high concentrations of alcohol. Not tea, not beer, not wine. But I met a dispensary owner who also shared his wife's recipe for marijuana-infused butter as part of a linguine and clam sauce recipe. Which
did you try?
I did not.
You did
I didn't
not.
Try the brownie recipe either. I'm not a recreational user.
Unlike Maureen Dowd, who apparently went to Colorado and...
Overdoubted, I think is the technical term for it.
On brownies. We have a comment actually from Dan. We talked about this earlier, but he says, can you talk about the difference between THC and CBD-based marijuana used for pain control?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think initially most of the studies of marijuana for pain control focused on THC. There were, though, some studies that used dronabinol, which is the synthetic form of THC in pill form, that didn't find any evidence of pain relief, really pretty underwhelming. And so that's made researchers interested in the possibility that you could actually get a lot of pain relief, maybe all of the pain relief that you'd get with marijuana, by decreasing the amount of THC down to pretty much nothing and increasing the concentration of CBD. And if that's true, then you could get all of the pain relief, particularly for neuropathic pain, without any of the high euphoric effects.
That was my 2015 interview with physician David Casaret about his book Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. Pennsylvania has legalized medical marijuana as of last weekend. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from Zephyr Teachout about the history of corruption in America. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks again for joining us today. Corruption has played, and I'm sorry for this, a huge role in this year's presidential campaign. This election cycle has seen two major candidates gaining popularity and getting rousing applause by railing against the influence of special interests, lobbyists, and Washington's relationship with the banking industry. And this discomfort makes sense, as the founders of this country intended the voters to have more power than the powerful. History professor Zephyr Teachout, whom Bernie Sanders endorsed as a candidate for Congress, has been an activist to clean up campaigns. She was a guest when her book Corruption in America, From Benjamin Franklin's Snuffbox to Citizens United, was published. Let's listen. Let's go back to France and King Louis XVI and Benjamin Franklin, and even the founders of this country. What were they grappling with when it came to writing the Constitution and thinking about corruption in government and money?
In a lot of ways, corruption was the animating danger at the Constitutional Convention, and not just the convention, but during that time as we were building this new country. And so they actually talked about corruption and thought about corruption and worried about corruption all the time.
Well, and I wonder, too, going back to the founders, how did they define corruption? And I think over time we've contracted and expanded the definition. How did they see corruption?
You know, it was so much part of their language. And I think you can think of this of anything that's so deeply part of your language. You don't sit around and define it if you're used to it. You know, people use the words, you know, whether democracy or love, words that are an essential part of your grammar. You're less likely to debate or define. So you don't see debates about it. But what you can conclude from all the discussions is that they were, one, very clearly not just talking about criminal law bribery. What they were talking about is when those with public power serve private ends, are greedy, instead of serving the public good. That sounds fuzzy at the margins.
It does.
That may be that it's difficult to apply in a particular instance, but that's true of all of our really important concepts like free speech or federalism. I argue that corruption is a concept like that, with that kind of weight, that's difficult to define at the margins, but the deep ambition is the ambition to protect against selfish, self-serving, greedy people in public power.
I'm curious about what happened when Benjamin Franklin came back to the United States with this snuff box. And you write about this.
Yeah, well, it was one of many gifts that the King of France had given to various diplomats. We had actually a acting provision. This is pre-constitutional provision that was based on something from the Netherlands, which said that you had to you could not accept these kinds of gifts. And this provision was so outside of the norm that actually one writer said it was against the law of nations.
Oh, wow.
That, you know, everybody gives gifts in diplomacy. That's what we do. But actually, the initial constitution didn't include it. And then it was re-included because the framers thought it was so important to protect against these kind of gifts. And I want to explain why. The fear was not that the king was bribing Franklin. It wasn't that he sort of said, here's a snuff box, and next time you get a chance, insert a positive provision in our trade deal. The concern is that it would actually affect Franklin's sentiments. And he would be
his feelings.
And so that when he was in a position to negotiate with France or to talk about foreign policy, he would think so favorably, he might be blinded to his own sort of sentimental attachments, and that that itself is a form of corruption. And I think they're very subtle about their understandings of things that could corrupt us. We don't always see them. They're not always brazen. But it would lead to him not serving the public good, instead serving the French interest. And so then in our Constitution, we do have this provision forbidding taking a gift of any kind whatsoever from a foreign power for those holding office. And, you know, it was honored in the breach from time to time, but it still was an important principle. It was saying we as Americans are different. We are stricter. We are afraid of gifts, actually. We are afraid that gifts can corrupt politics.
But we do know that leaders and monarchs do still give gifts, for instance, to the president. I don't know. Are they just kept in a gigantic warehouse somewhere?
Well, to be clear, you're allowed to keep the gift if Congress gives permission. And actually, this really bothered Thomas Jefferson. So Jefferson, I love as a character because he's sort of our favorite hypocrite. He both holds up the highest standards and then violates those standards. That's certainly true with slavery. Also true with this gift-giving provision. And now he was very strict about these questions of gifts and corruption. Yet when he himself later was given a diamond-encrusted gift, At first he tried to resist it because he just didn't want the embarrassment of going in front of Congress to ask permission to keep it. And then he didn't resist it, but told his assistant to take all the diamonds out, sell them, and put the money towards his own account. And he hid the whole affair entirely.
Why does that have a kind of familiar ring to
yes.
it, right? But this is, I guess, human nature up against these values, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually think that's why the rules are so important. Not because even the best among us might not violate them, but because they're kind of speed limits on our own ethical obligations. Maybe I'm mixing metaphors too much there, but these rules give us guideposts about, wait a second, we might be actually overstepping the bounds. And if there's clear lines saying this is ethically acceptable and this isn't, that helps us serve our public better.
I do want to get to the 20th century and even the 21st century talking about this, but just spend a little bit of time on the 19th century, which we do think of as a time of robber barons and the building of the railroads and the various scandals associated with this expanding country. How do you see that fitting in?
Oh, there's so much really interesting history. So, excuse me. So you have this, you know, this constitution built around protecting against corruption. And, you know, Mason said, if we don't protect against corruption, we will soon be at an end. And Hamilton said, you know, when asked about what we did at the Constitutional Convention, he wrote, we erected every practicable obstacle against corruption. So they saw this as this anti-corruption document. And then, of course, the country begins with a scandal. And one of the first scandals that really occupied our country actually for decades was the Yazoo scandal. So in Yazoo, the Yazoo lands in western Georgia, were sold for basically pennies on the acre, what somebody called the real estate deal of the century. The legislature of Georgia allowed this sale, and over half of the legislators actually had stock and had a financial interest in the sale themselves. So the people of Georgia were understandably very upset. They'd lost this major asset, kicked out every single legislator, set fire to the law that had granted this land to these private companies. They actually literally had a bonfire, passed a new law saying that law is void, and then assumed that they owned the land. But there was this legal question, and my research is really about the law, less about the scandals necessarily are part of it, but it was like, what does corruption mean? How does corruption work in law? How does this difficult concept work in law? So the legal question, which is really tricky, is a law not a law, or because it was passed corruptly? Is a law not a law because over 50% of the legislators were bribed? Or can you overturn those laws? And that's, you know, you can understand why that's a really tricky question for the mm-hmm. courts. The Supreme Court Justice Marshall ended up deciding that it was just too difficult to figure out in any given case whether a law had been passed corruptly or not, and so upheld the sale.
But I wonder whether the fact that so many of these legislators were kicked out, whether it's the courts or the law says, well, then the voters step in and they, in a sense, void the law.
Well, actually, that's
even if they don't set fire to it.
Right. Well, election helps, but it doesn't help so much if you've already lost all your assets. And so that was why it was a tricky question. But in response to that and several other scandals, you see the rise of something that was relatively new at the time, which is these criminal bribery laws. Because actually, when that happened in Georgia, there were none of those legislators could be put in jail because there was no laws against legislative bribery. So you see a rise of criminal bribery laws, and then you also see the rise of a real concern around lobbying.
Mm.
And really for 80 years of our history, lobbying was either illegal or against the public policy of the states. It was a felony in California. The 1877 Constitution of Georgia included lobbying as a crime in the Constitution. And, you know, my favorite stories actually involve the court cases around lobbying, though.
So when did all that change?
Well, it actually changed kind of gradually. When I was reading the cases, it felt sometimes more like, you know, the way your coat or shawl slips off the back of your chair and then you can't find it. It felt that like that gradual slipping away more than a sudden reversal. And it really changes in the 1910s, 1920s, and 1930s. And what you see is a few different things. First, courts are far more likely to enforce contracts across the board and not have this public policy exception, like just the idea that if you make a contract, that's your business. And the second is that you see really the creation of the modern First Amendment. And those two together combine in these incremental cases to erode this old law, set of laws and establish lobbying in its current position, which is exactly the opposite. It's not seen as corrupt. It's seen as sort of the epitome of protected First Amendment speech.
Which is so interesting. And there was a very important case in the 20th century, the
Buckley versus Vallejo.
Vallejo.
In 1976.
Which kind of set the stage for this idea that speech and money were somehow connected.
Yeah. I like to joke that, you know, Benjamin Franklin said that our country would last a couple hundred years, but we didn't think he'd be so precise because Buckley versus Vallejo was 1976. And in that case, the Supreme Court struck down parts of a federal law that was designed to do something about campaign finance. This is in the sort of post-Watergate era. The Supreme Court upheld laws that limited how much you could contribute to a candidate, but struck down the laws that limited how much you could spend on a campaign. And you have to understand how unusual this is. In Europe, there's limitations on how much you can spend, not just how much you can contribute. And it did so because it said You know, spending money is First Amendment protected speech in this context.
Is that making the connection between lobbyists? I mean, people who get paid to express an opinion to our elected officials?
Yes. So that case wasn't actually about lobbying, but it did epitomize a view that political speech is the most protected speech and money spent around political speech is the most protected speech.
And that's where we are today.
And that's where we are today.
So it's really just that sort of overt bribery, right? Is that now there our narrow definition of corruption?
Yeah. You start to see this in 2007 again, which is the case that piqued my interest, when Justice Roberts actually gets impatient. He says, enough is enough. If you think corruption is anything, and he actually uses that phrase, enough is enough, period. He's responding to the dissent's view that corruption is something more than explicit bribery. But after 2007, in Citizens United, one of the key reasons the Supreme Court struck down outside corporate spending in Citizens United is because there was no evidence that it was protecting against explicit quid pro quo bribery. It was protecting against broad corruption, but not that explicit quid pro quo bribery. And then last year, the Supreme Court not only made it very clear that explicit quid pro quo bribery was the only kind of corruption, it actually cited to a federal statute. So corruption is no longer treated as this foundational principle, but rather something that you can look at in a federal criminal bribery law statute.
Are we talking about then legal corruption? I mean, I don't even know if that phrase exists.
No, yes, it is. And I actually think if you talk to people anywhere in the country except the Supreme Court, they talk about corruption in this way. I think the Supreme Court has gone off on this very narrow idea that it's got to be criminal law bribery. But I think people feel very comfortable calling a situation corrupt, even if nobody's going away in handcuffs.
Does it also raise questions about perhaps Congress not playing its role as a third branch of government? Is there something you think Congress could do to not just challenge the court, but also to raise some of these issues?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there's other things that are happening now. For one, you see over 50% of Congress members are now becoming lobbyists after they leave office. And actually, the framers were concerned about a variation of this. They called it the problem of placemen, people who would
place
go.
Men.
Yeah. People who would go into office, go into elected office in order to get an appointed office from the king. And so the problem was they would basically just serve the king instead of serving their constituencies. Now we have the problem of placemen, but it's people serving their future employers, serving the lobbyists that they're going to work for. And we could certainly do more with the revolving door. And, you know, members of Congress, I think, are realizing that most Americans are opposed to Citizens United. And so many have come forward supporting a constitutional amendment. But what they could do is actually change the way that campaigns are funded. And they're scared to do it because it changes what their jobs are. You know, they're used to their job of being, you know, fundraiser. Basically, you know, the job of being a congressperson now is basically the job of being a salesperson. How many calls can you make? What percentage can you hit?
And they all complain about it, but they all do it.
But they're still scared. Yeah. And I think, you know, there is actually a great opportunity for Congress to act and recognize that they should fundamentally change their jobs, but fundamentally uncorrupt Congress by a public financing scheme.
That was my 2015 interview with history professor and candidate for the U.S. House in New York, Zephyr Teachout, about her book, Corruption in America. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.